interesting dynamic of preaching through books of the Bible is there are chapters you probably would never preach otherwise. Chapter 34 is probably one of those. I remember reading it, and I was having this weird thought, because, you know, Thursday night we went out and got to enjoy a great time with the community. I had several folks over the school said, hey, we probably ought to drop in and check out the church sometime. And I thought, this is such a weird week for somebody to come visit. Because I'm going home and reading over. Chapter 34, at first pass, feels very randomly placed in Genesis. When you come to the flow, you're going to say, where I was and where we were going, why'd we end up here? You guys can take a vote on the... Part of it is, we get lost in the small context of a book, and there's a bigger picture that's been forming together. In the last couple weeks, the last couple of passages we've looked at really stand on their own quite nicely. You can read them, see how they apply to our own situation. And yeah, we make reference to the bigger theological themes that Genesis is addressing, but you don't have to hold it all together. We are coming to the end of a very large arc in where Genesis has been going. In chapters 34 and 35, we're going to wrap up Isaac's story. You might have forgot that Isaac was still an unresolved part of the storyline because we've been chasing Jacob, but Isaac's not dead yet. He will be by the end of today, but he's not dead yet. And there's, anytime you're going through a history like this, we know that you're not getting everything that happened. Genesis is long, but it's not that long. And so, as God's inspiring Moses to put this together, there's pieces of the story that he's including for the big picture's value. And so we need to see chapter 34 and 35 as bringing together many of the issues that were begun with Isaac and his journey, and what God's been doing with Isaac, and many of the things that were begun with Jacob. We've been on a progression. Remember, when Jacob left home, it was because through his own dishonesty and treachery, he had a brother who wanted to kill him. And in a sense, we've been sort of waiting for Isaac's funeral since then, because Esau's statement was, my father is old, his death is near. I'll wait till he dies and we're done grieving, then I'm killing Jacob. And so Jacob leaves with nothing, fleeing for his life, and he sleeps on this stone, and he gets this vision of God, and God makes covenant with Jacob, affirming to him that I am going to bless you, I am going to be your God. And in that covenant, God said, you will return. I will bring you back to Bethel, and I will bring you back to the land of your fathers to give it to you. So we've been on this long journey, but all along you have to be anticipating Jacob's return to Bethel and Jacob's return to Isaac. And those are going to happen in chapter 35, where we bring that back together. Every time we've gone through a generational transition in Genesis, before one generation dies off, we introduce the next characters. And every time we've done so, we've been made painfully aware that just because God has done a work in their parents, sin is still reigning in the kids. We met Isaac, and as Isaac shifted to center stage, we saw that Isaac lies a lot like his dad. We met Jacob and Esau, and their introductions were not great. In fact, we saw that they lie like their dad. There's deception and treachery that's been running. The bondage of sin and death is ever present. And so at no point are we presenting that this covenant is earned. It's always been by grace. And in that big picture, chapter 34 is going to make a lot of sense. Because you're about to see that the sons of Jacob need grace, that they are sinners. And as we introduce them and move into the transition where they're going to become the characters we're following, before we wrap up Isaac and reaffirm the covenant, we reaffirm that it's a covenant of grace. And what you're going to come away from when we're done looking at this passage is two things. Each generation must have their own encounter with the grace of God. Jacob's children are not magically sanctified because of what God has done in the life of Jacob, as awesome as chapter 33 was in seeing the transformation of Jacob. They have to get their own. And yet also you're going to see some painful silences in this passage where Jacob's a letdown. And you're going to see that each generation must bear witness to the truth of God. There's a need for the kids to make their faith their own. There's a need for the parents to speak the truth that God has revealed to them in their own walk with Him. And in a very bittersweet way, these two chapters will bring that out. So let me read through chapters 34 and 35. I'm reading from the ESV. Shouldn't be too different if you're reading from a different one. Either way, it'll be disappointing. So follow along with me. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this girl for my wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. The sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they heard of it. And the men were indignant and very angry because he had done this outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife. Make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. You shall dwell with us and the land shall be open to you. Dwell and trade in it and get property in it." Shechem also said to his father and to her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you will say to me, I will give. Ask me for a great bride price and gift as you will, and I will give whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife." The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are by every male among you being circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter, and we will be gone." Their words pleased Hamor and Hamor's son Shechem. And the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most honored of all his father's house. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of the city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Let them dwell in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men agree to dwell with us to become one people, when every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock, their property, and their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will dwell with us." And all who went out of the gate of the city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. On the third day, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field. All their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the houses they captured and plundered. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land. The Canaanites and the Perizzites, my numbers are few. And if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?" God said to Jacob, "Arise and go to Bethel and dwell there. Make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So Jacob said to his household and all who were with him, Put away the foreign gods that are among you, and purify yourselves, and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, so that I may make there an altar to God who answers me in the day of my distress, and has been with me everywhere I have gone. So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods that they had, and the rings that were in their ears. Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree that was near Shechem. And as they journeyed, a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. And Jacob came to Luz, that is, Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And there he built an altar and called the place El Bethel, because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. And Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried under the oak below Bethel. So he called the name Alon Bakuth. God appeared to Jacob again. When he came from Padan Aram, and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. No longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel, and God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations will come from you, and kings shall come from your own body. The land that I give Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you." Then God went up from him in the place where he had spoken to him. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone. He poured out a drink offering on it and poured oil on it. So Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke to him Bethel. Then they journeyed from Bethel. When they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel went into labor, and she had hard labor. And when her labor was at its hardest, the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, for you have another son." And as her soul was departing, for she was dying, she called his name Benoni, but his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar over her tomb. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. While Israel lived in the land, Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12, the sons of Leah, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, the sons of Rachel, Joseph, and Benjamin, the sons of Bilhah, Rachel's servant, Dan, and Naphtali, the sons of Zilpah, Leah's servant, Gad, and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. And Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kiriath Arba, that is, Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac breathed his last, and he died, and was gathered to his people, old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. There's a lot of themes, especially in that second chapter, that should be familiar in our journey through Genesis. We remember when Abraham died, we have his two sons coming back together and burying him. We got the same picture here at Isaac's death, as his two sons come together and are there at his burial. And a lot of chapter 35 is bringing these things back together. We've got reference of Deborah, who was the nurse of Jacob's mom, apparently traveling with him. She passes away. As we're wrapping up all these loose ends, because the promise that we've had for Abraham and Isaac is now very clearly with Jacob. It's been affirmed at Bethel as he returns to the land of promise. God has carried him safely there. So there's a lot of that resolution, a lot of these themes that we see. Even in a larger sense, there's pairings that go all the way back to chapter 25 where the order has been repeated and is contrasting. And so in some ways we see God's faithfulness. God delivers Jacob just as he said. God is bringing him back and bringing the promise about. But the picture we get in chapter 34 is rough. One of the commentaries says, part of the struggle with chapter 34 is there are no heroes in chapter 34. There's no good guys. In fact, the total absence of God in chapter 4 is startling. in the past, even in rough situations, somebody had the sense to pray. When Jacob's returning and Esau is coming, it's punctuated with the presence of God and appeals to God. Jacob saying, "You know, O God who has delivered me from my distress, save me now." Chapter 34, everybody is shooting from the hip and doing their own thing. They're reacting to what's going on, but God is not being consulted. And so it's just a self-centered mess. This is unfortunately a perfect picture of what sin is. It's everybody doing their own thing outside of relationship with God. And the destructive consequences just piling up and flashing back and forth. We say sin produces death, and chapter 34 says amen. There's a whole lot of death here. We see the generational sin still present. We noted Abraham lies when he has friction with foreign countries to protect his wife. Isaac plays the same game, and there's accusations of treachery. Jacob, tables are turned. Laban lies to Jacob over wife issues. Now we're here with Jacob's kids. We just can't seem to be honest with foreigners. And this one is just like, we thought Jacob was bad. We thought Isaac was bad. We thought Abraham was bad. Wow, look at their kids. How many times do we see the sins of the parents showing up in the kids and just getting worse? When we talk about the bondage of sin being passed on from generation to generation, we see that here. And so we have Dinah goes out to explore the land. We don't get a lot of explanation of how this goes down. The words used to describe Dinah are used for a young girl. Normally, the types of terms they're using puts her maybe around 12. So there is nothing admirable about Shechem and his dad that he sees this young girl and forces her. Some of your translations say he raped her. Others say he lied with her and humiliated her. It's not abundantly clear from the language. Hebrew doesn't have a word for rape. So the humiliating probably infers it. But the rest of the passage says everyone else understood it as rape. That she was defiled. That this was an outrage. And yet the response to it is just, well, let's go buy her. Let's make it okay by convincing your dad to let us marry her. Nowhere in here do we even care where Dinah's at on this or how she's handling it. She's background and everybody's just busy being mad at each other and trying to leverage this for their own personal gain. I mean, the whole angle is, yeah, we defiled your daughter, but you can get a great trade agreement out of this. That's the dad's pitch. Jacob is woefully silent. He gets word that his daughter has been exploited and just holds his peace. When his boys hear of it, they are rightfully outraged. And Shechem and Hamor come to meet with them, and the boys do all the negotiating and all the conversation. We don't have Jacob speaking, even though it uses the language of our daughter. It's a lot like when Jacob goes and Laban's involved in negotiating the marriage for Jacob. When Isaac goes and Laban's involved in the marriage for Isaac, the brother actually does a lot of the negotiation, and Laban's dad stays silent most of that conversation. So we got the brothers entering in. They're outraged. That's great. They should be. Their solution is just nasty. They defile what ought to have been sacred in a treacherous play to just murder and take vengeance into their own hands. They tell these guys, well, we can't enter into trade with you, and we can't marry you because you're not circumcised. And then they wait till everybody's been circumcised, and while they're defenseless, they just charge in and massacre an entire city. It says they kill all the males. A whole bunch of guys who were not necessarily involved in what happened here are tricked into a painful situation and then murdered. That's how this goes down. This is the dishonesty, the treachery, and the rage that's being just unleashed. The first time Jacob speaks up is in self-interest. You guys might have overreacted, and that could be bad for us. They might attack us now. We've yet to hear Dad say something about his daughter. And even then, in correcting him, he doesn't say, you lied, you tricked. He just says, this might go over bad with the neighbors. We're just going, where is God? Where is the transformation? This has been a pattern throughout Genesis, that when we see affirmations of God's covenant faithfulness, that we see human depravity right next to it. In a sense, we're just echoing what was said after the flood. When God says, I'll make a covenant with you, and even though you are sinful from birth, yet I will not destroy you. The strong affirmation that what God is doing is not earned. You can't come through 34 and think these people deserve God's covenant. You can't think that God picked Israel and his kids because they were morally superior or had shaped up and become the better people. Just a bunch of sinners. And God is doing this because he chooses to do it by grace. And since 35 is going to affirm God's covenant intentions, 34, make sure you don't get the wrong idea. It's grace. It's grace all. It also reminds you that Jacob's sons do not necessarily inherit from Jacob the righteousness God has done. And it sets us up for a pattern that's spiraling up in Genesis. As we see the wickedness of each generation, God in his covenant faithfulness is not just planning to send a Messiah who will deliver them from condemnation. That's big. But he's actually taking them through a series, a journey that will transform them. We've seen that in the way Abraham was sent out to sojourn as God works with him and develops his faith and goes through trials and suffering that change him. And after that, God comes back and makes an affirmation that the faith at the outset has borne fruit that God had promised. We've seen this in Jacob, that in his sin, God is going to deliver him. But deliverance means an exile into Padan Aram that's only just now coming back with a changed Jacob, who still needs some changing. And now we see the brokenness in his sons that helps foreshadow what's coming. Their own exodus into Egypt, which will lead into the more classic exodus that we're familiar with, where all of Israel spends a season away from the promised land as God deals with them and eventually draws them out and delivers them, as he delivered Jacob, as he's delivered Abraham. All of this plays into the bigger exodus of Genesis, which is the exodus of the garden. These are pictures of what God is ultimately going to fix through these people. And as he interacts with them, there's a message for all of us. All of us are the treacherous son. All of us are the self-centered one who is reaping death in our own lives and in the relationships around us, and have to be expelled from the place of promise. We've been booted from the garden of God's presence. And yet God in his grace will be faithful to his promise, just as sure as he brings Jacob back to Bethel, just as sure as he brings Abraham back to the land of promise and protects him there, and just as sure as later he's going to draw all of Israel back out of Egypt to make a people for himself. He comes in Jesus to draw all men back to himself, to deliver them from not just the bondage of a treacherous Laban, or the slavery of Egypt, but the big message in Genesis, which is the bondage of sin and death. And so this pattern is just cycling and getting bigger and bigger, and we're seeing that the hope of humanity is the promise of God, and the hope of humanity is the salvation God offers. But we also see our season now as an exile that God can work through to purify us and begin to break the bondage of sin in our daily life too. So Genesis is bringing these pictures back together. They've been running. We've seen a couple loops. We're at the end of a bigger loop. This next one's going to be even bigger. As we travel out through Egypt to Moses and back, generations are going to pass. But the same basic idea is here. And the challenge is here that each generation has to come and accept God's promise for themselves. The promise is by grace. They don't earn it. And it's not like God's deciding whether or not he's going to offer it. The offer stands. But what we see in Jacob's kids is they need an encounter for themselves. When Thursday came out on Wednesday to baptism, when Daisy was baptized, she alluded to a statement that's common in our York church. Daisy became interested in seeing her life change because of the testimony of Neo. Some of you guys have met Neo. If you've met Neo, you know, because you had no personal space afterwards. Neo's journey was one of addiction, in and out of prison more than once, before God got a hold of his life and changed him. And so when he walks around York, he gets a little bit of attention because a lot of guys know him from way back. And when they see him with the joy that he has, and they see that it's been now 2 years, and he's still clean, not gone back to his drugs, that he's working, that he's working to redeem relationships with his family and his siblings. Folks like Daisy come and say, "How do I get that, Neil? I want what you have." And Neil has a line that comes out right away if you ask him that question. He goes, "Get your own. You can't have mine. I had to go to Jesus to get mine. You got to go to him too. I can't help you." And he's passionate that you can't just hang out with Neo and pick it up. You got to get it from Jesus. That Neo had been around lots of other Christian people, but there's no secondary faith. And so when Daisy got baptized, part of her testimony, she said, "I got mine." And that was a direct reference to the tension there. "I got mine. I went to Jesus for me." And I look at Jacob's kids. They still need to get their own. They've lived under the blessing of God through Jacob. They've seen faith in God through Jacob. They don't have it. They don't look to God for deliverance. They don't have a transforming work and a brokenness like Jacob has. In fact, what you see is them doing a lot of the same. In fact, one of the great ironic tragedies here was that brief passing message mentioned in chapter 35. After Bethel, they're traveling, and it says that Reuben goes and sleeps with Jacob's concubine, and Jacob heard of it. And then it just drops it. Nothing happens. This is loaded, because we just got done with the reaffirmation of the covenant, and explicitly in that reaffirmation was the royal nature of what was being said. He says, "Kings and nations will come from you." All through the ancient Near East, and actually all through what the scripture to come, stealing wives is a sign of usurping power. When Absalom rebels against David, he's counseled to go sleep with David's concubines. And so he goes and puts his tent on top of the house that they're in. And it says he went in and laid with them before all Israel. In other words, he made sure it was real public that everybody knew what he was doing. Because it was a sign that he was stealing the authority of his dad. Foreign kings trying to negotiate treaties with Israel that are in their favor will say, "You have to give me all your wives." Often when Israel is conquered, the foreign kings take all the wives back. The stealing of and the sleeping with the concubines and wives is a sign of usurping power. So here is Jacob being promised by God this blessing, and here is Reuben trying to steal it. It's tragic irony that the one who tries to steal birthrights grows up to have his own kids try to steal his own rights. You're seeing the mess of sin as it continues, and the brokenness in the homes, and the challenge that's coming here. These kids need to understand who this God is, and they need to come and have his grace experience for themselves. On the other side of it, Jacob's silence is disturbing. While your own faith can't make your kids believe, you do have a duty to speak to what you've learned from God. Jacob is silent in chapter 34 in the face of sexual misconduct, in the face of usurping authority and treachery. As a lot of scholars reading that wonder out loud, if Jacob had spoke up and treated this appropriately, would Reuben have been so bold to do what he did in 35? Because what he saw in his dad is that you can take lightly sexual boundaries, and that his dad's influence is nothing, that his dad is content to set back and abdicate the authority and influence he has. In Jacob's silence, he loses his influence on his sons. Reuben is responsible for his own actions. And clear over in chapter 49, when we someday get there, you'll find that Reuben actually loses his birthright over this. Well, right after this happens, it notes explicitly in the text, Reuben, his firstborn. When Jacob is at the end of his life and prophesies over his kids, he says, "Reuben will not have the firstborn's blessing because he defiled my bed." And instead it goes to the two children of Joseph. And that's how they come in to the blessing of the sons, even though they're grandchildren. Jacob adopts them as his own and gives Reuben's blessing. So Reuben, in his sinfulness, loses a lot here. And so his responsibility is on his head, but if his dad
had been speaking the truth he knew of God. We know Jacob. We've seen the transformation in his own ethics. We saw a Jacob who had learned to be selfless, right? When Esau's coming, Jacob goes out in front of his wives and children, which was not a very Jacob move. He's coming to understand the values of God. He's been transformed by his encounters with God. But when he doesn't speak to it in front of his kids, he loses his influence, and they go on to commit similar sins as him and reap consequences. There's a challenge. You can't save somebody else, but you got to speak to what God has done. And so we're seeing the closing of Jacob's story. He'll be a background player in the chapters to come. The kids are stepping up, and we're seeing that the tension remains. God is a faithful God of promise, promising to save. Each generation must accept it by faith. There is a duty for those who know God to speak up what they've seen and learned of God. All right, I'm going to pause here in a sec to take questions. But so what do we do with a passage like this? Where do we come? When you break out in your discussion groups in a little bit, the three questions I want you to chew on. First one should be nice and fun. Who are the examples of godly faith that you look up to and why? Jacob's sons had an example in what God had done in Jacob. They just didn't take the faith of Jacob and make it their own. Who are those people? When I say somebody that you know lives out, has clear witness of faith in God, who are those people in your life? Question two then follows up on that and says, when and how did the faith you admire in them become your own? Or has it? Are you still comfortable with a second-hand faith? Oh, I know that's good, and I know that what God calls of us, and I'm so glad that they're doing it. There's no such thing as secondhand faith. You either have faith or you don't. If you recognize that's the real deal and you don't got it, then there's a challenge for you that maybe you've been riding in a confidence of the faith of those over you and around you. And like Neil would say, you need to go get your own. There's 100 cliches we use in church about this. You know, being in a car doesn't make, being in a garage doesn't make you a car. Being in Israel's family didn't make them saved. They still needed to be set free from sin. So, when and how did that faith become your own? And then the third question is from the other side of it, looking at Jacob. How can our church bear witness to God's truth and God's grace to the next generation? It's a fun question for us because our church is largely made up of the next generation. A lot of churches sit here with a generational divide. I think that's still a big issue. It's still our duty. If you've had an encounter with God's grace and been changed by it, then you have an obligation to speak. Let me pause here, because this will be our last run through 34 and 35. Any questions from the text before you go into your group discussions?
How do they break this generational sin that's going on?
Yeah, I think that's one of the tensions that Genesis wants us to see. Is we get our hopes up because Jacob really made some headway in chapter 33. And then 34 is such a letdown because his kids actually got worse. I think that's the question you have to be asking, is realizing no amount of personal change can save. Because if Jacob getting broken and changing his ways could have fixed his kids, then we don't need Jesus to come. Because apparently just walking in faith in an Old Testament sort of way was enough. I think the fact that you see that even though God is delivering and saving in the Old Testament, the cycle's never broken, says then the promise is still incomplete. And so the hope has to be still waiting out into the future. And so I think there's twofold. It has to come through Jesus and what Jesus does. And in another sense, we believe that sin will still be here till Jesus comes back. So we understand that sin's presence has to be totally eradicated at Jesus' return. So I don't know that there's a magic bullet or a magic formula. Much as we always want that, right? Just do this and your kids will turn out awesome. No, your kid's a sinner from the womb, so you can do it all right and he still will definitely be a sinner. And it's a reminder to us that our hope is not here. Our hope is in the one who's coming. that we don't have it all yet, and we look forward in anticipation. If we felt like we could just fix it on our own, we would take sin for granted. So I don't care what your pedigree is, I don't care how awesome your parents were or were not. You have to face your sin, and you're only going to find relief personally through you and Jesus connecting up. I can't do that for you. Jacob was able to break out of it. We do see a transformed Jacob in his honesty before Esau. It's just that that doesn't bequeath down to his kids. It just delivers Jacob. So even though there's a corporate thing going on, salvation is still individual. So if I say, how do we break the cycle? Well, that's a corporate question. The whole world don't get better until Jesus comes back. But if you want to ask specifically, how can I break out of the cycles of my family's sin? Well, I can get right with Jesus. I might break out of the cycle. Cycle will still run, but I don't have to be a part of it. So there is hope on the individual level. Each of us coming and having an encounter with grace, I think there's deliverance. But I have to be able to be broken myself and accept the grace of God. No one can do that for me. Which is why we preach the gospel, why we call people to repent. Just coming here or just being associated with church Christians won't do it. You have to personally get there.
So the verse that says, the sins of the father are visited to the children of the third and fourth generation of them that don't love God or them that hate God. I can't remember how it goes. But is in essence saying that that's the channel, that's the natural flow of things, and the father himself can't break that channel for his children.
If they hate God, they can keep on reaping sin.
Yeah. Okay. And so Jacob's turnaround at Bethel
didn't undo his kids.
Still left the channel flowing.
Right.
And
it broke Jacob.
It's a responsibility to deal with their thing. But they should a father then be teaching in his family what his weakness is so that they can know that they have a proclivity for it.
Yeah, and that's my point on Jacob can't save them. They got to have their own encounter. Jacob could have spoke up. The repetition of Jacob's silences here, because it's repeated, I think is intentional on the side of the author. He wants us to get mad at Jacob and go, Jacob, say something. He held his peace. This happened. And Jacob heard of it. Moving on. And he, nothing? Come on, Jacob. But here's the thing. Sometimes dads assume their kids know the story. I'm the middle child, so, you know, my dad could tell his own story several times before I'm even born. Three siblings older than me. I still need to hear what God has done in my dad's life. And it's powerful as a child to hear the truth of God declared by your parents in their own personal encounter with grace. It's part of why baptism on Wednesday was such an encouraging event, as we heard people share of their encounter. That doesn't save me. I can't be like, well, I went to a baptism, so I'm a Christian. I was a spectator, but yeah. Now, I got to have my own encounter, but as I hear them declare the truth of God in their own lives, that certainly gives me the opportunity to respond. So you can't save them, they got to have their own encounter, but you do have an obligation to declare the truth of God. And so I think for fathers especially, where God has dealt with you, you have something to say to your kids, and they need to hear it. And that's not just a dad thing, but it's at least a dad thing.
These instances where God calls to Jacob, like the beginning of 35, move on to Bethel. And, you know, Jacob instructs his household to destroy the idols. They bury the idols. They move on, and God, you know, instructs him to erect an altar. You know, you think he's traveling with his family, and you think they're asking, well, why are we burying idols and what's going on? It just, you know, I mean, the narrative only talks about Jacob.
Right.
Given these instructions and building these altars, you got to assume that
there's a whole
kids, come on, help me build this altar.
Because remember, when he leaves Laban, it says that he doesn't just leave with his kids. He leaves with male servants and female servants. Yeah. So you've got a whole group that comes from Padam Aram with him, who's been still journeying. And they just massacred a city. But did you notice when they massacred the city, they killed all the dudes. And then all the women and children, they took them.
Yeah.
So the already big group of servants got bigger, and it definitely just had a pagan influx. So when he says, we got to get rid of, I mean, he's looking at his camp, and thank you, sons, our idol quotient has gone up. We already got Rachel with the household gods from Laban sneaking along anyway. So it's not like these are the first idols in camp. But he's going, I'm supposed to go with God? Not with this crew, I can't. And so you see that Jacob's aware it's gotten out of control. And so there's a sense of, I got to clean up before I can go face God because we're a mess. I think that, again, affirms that 34 is a picture of their dysfunction.
But, yeah, but their kids are not seeing what his father's going through.
These
cleansings from time to time we have to clean house.
If it's that big of a camp, unless he explicitly mentions they're there, we don't know if they are or not.
Right.
He can be doing this and they can be just chilling in their tents because they're a small village at this point. They're clearly not picking up on it. Any other questions from the text? Before we break into discussion groups.
Quick question. Can I throw this picture?
Go for it. Can you hit me?
What son did Jesus come?
Right. Jesus comes to Judah as a kingly line. So he's royal, the promise to David that's still coming.
Okay, so he came through the line of Judah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not Reuben. Reuben, firstborn, ends up losing all of his position and status, is never treated as firstborn, even as a tribe.
I assume it was Joseph.
No, he's king. Jesus brings a whole other fun question because he's priest and king. So you're like, well, maybe he should have been Levi. Moses was priestly. So there's fun stuff there, but we'll leave it alone for now.
You know how they call him the Lion of Judah? A couple times it talks about Jesus as the Lion of Judah.
Son of David.
Help you and the Son of David. If you didn't know, David is the Son of David.
All right. Break into your groups. And you got three different questions to discuss. Go ahead and try and get a group of maybe five or six. This morning the groups were kind of on the large size. And these are fun questions. I think we actually have some really good discussions.